my terrible tummy. Now, look here. Tomorrow's Friday, Freya's day. Boy, she was a hot goddess. Goddess of fertility and all that kind of good stuff. So we'll see you tomorrow. Terrible tummy, off and clear.
Gentlemen, this is Mona Montgomery with this evening's edition of The Hula Hoax.
There were no juice skin lampshades, and there was no pure juice soap in Germany. That's all lies. Just like the president of Iran says, perpetrated on the white race to demoralize Germany and other white people. But nobody knows this fact, and everybody buys the Hula Hoax stories to this day because they're being broadcast throughout the world on the Jew-controlled media and in all of the schools all over the world as well. Only a few Muslims know the truth because they are equally the victim of the Jew to the white race. And so at this time in history, we need to ally ourselves with the Muslims with the understanding that we don't want to marry them or live with them, but that we will share with them and listen to them, give them our evidence and listen to their evidence against this hellish race, the Jews who control the planet, because we let them do it. And that's a terrible thing we have to face. It isn't anybody's fault except our own, with the almost a million years that we've been alive on this planet. All of our parents have told us throughout history to stay away from the Jews and the blacks and the non-whites. Because if we don't, simply by virtue of the recessive quality of our genes, our race becomes destroyed. But we didn't listen to our parents. Some of you are young and had parents my age, and I'm afraid you were victimized by people my age, because we taught the people in my generation taught our children that the very best thing you could do would be to marry a Negro and have a little mulatto baby, since that's the way we were brainwashed. But until this recent apostasy has taken over the planet, that race mixing serves the will of God, we have generations and thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years of loyalty within our race. We can prove that just by looking at ourselves. We don't appear to be anything but white. Some of us are a little fat, a little short, our hair has gotten a little brown, our eyes have turned brown, but we still bear the mark of the pure white race. So the amount of damage that's been done to us is minimal at this point, and we need to keep it that way, because if we don't, we're going to see the entire planet covered with brown people, as has become true in, for instance, Egypt, which was originally pure white people who built those first pyramids, and then going against their own laws, their own genetic laws, our people intermarried with blacks and browns in Egypt, so that today the Egyptian is a dark Turkish-looking person. And that can happen. It can happen in a few generations. Just look at the difference between the gene pool in Europe today and the gene pool that came over the Berlin Wall 10 years ago. I was struck, as you probably were too, by this bevy of blonde that came flooding into Western Germany after the Berlin Wall fell down. That's because that Berlin Wall had been protecting the gene pool in Russia so that our people did not mix. But if you look at the same time period of birth in Western Europe, in Western Germany, you see darker people. That's just 20 years or 50 years. That's the difference. So it comes very fast, and it's pretty much inexorable. So you see, our big problem is that we have to fight like cats and dogs to prevent anyone from marrying into our race. Marriage and interbreeding is a worse threat to us than weapons, because once it's done, and the results are horrible. You can be a beautiful blonde person or a brown-haired, brown-eyed person, but have all of the characteristics of a white person. And in just one generation, you throw away a legacy of 800,000 years, and it can't be gotten back again. Although the Bible does give us hope that in 10 generations of loyal breeding, you will regain your status as a white person. You see the same thing in India. The Brahmin caste, which is the top caste of the Hindus, is white. And you can look at this in the Hindu writing. Buddha was a terrible person. Buddha was a person who preached race mixing and thought that by spreading the religion of the Brahmin caste to the lower caste, everyone would be happy, everyone could be enlightened, but that was ridiculous. And Hinduism made it very clear, you can't expect the lower classes or the lower races to understand or appreciate the God of the higher race. In the Hindu religion, and most of you realize that the Aryans took over India at some point in time and established Hinduism, which is a caste system based on race. If you will go just ride right past Buddhism and go to Hinduism, you'll see it right there in plain writing. There's the white race, or the white caste, the Brahmin caste, that's the upper caste. And then there's the red caste, and then there's the yellow caste, and the lowest caste is the black caste. And they use these colors to differentiate the caste, and then they describe the different attributes of these different castes. And each of the castes has their own concept of God that's appropriate to that caste. The upper caste, the white caste, which to this day has Anglo-Saxon features, but due to race mixing, the skin color has, alas, gotten dark. The upper caste believes, as Jesus taught, that God is love and that everything emanates from the force of good, which is God, the unfathomable origin of life, with whom you cooperate in order to profit yourself. The lower caste, the black caste, uses these strange gods like Kali to practice voodoo on one another, because that's the best they can do in their understanding. They don't have the intelligence to reason things out and believe that God is love. They have to have a picture of a god. They have to have a picture of Kali, for instance, who's very ugly and sticks her tongue out at the world and has a whole bunch of severed heads hanging on a scarf around her neck and has eight hands. And we'll do evil things for you if you make a little statue of Kali. If you're a Negro, you can stick pins into something and your enemy allegedly is harmed. Of course, we know that that's not true. There's no such thing to magic, but I imagine it's a very beneficial thing. If you're angry at somebody, to sit down in front of a statue and stick pins into your enemy, because it at least releases your anger. And so going up into the other caste, the yellow caste and the red caste, you have different religions that more and more emulate the idea that God is love. But the caste system was completely unbridgeable. In fact, to this day, if you happen to be born into the Brahmin caste, you will see, if you look in the mirror, beautiful Anglo-Saxon features, although your eyes will be dark and your skin will be dark. and your hair will be dark. And you are told as a child that it's against the law of your religion to marry out of your caste. And today's Indian children are coming to America, and they're being taught that that's not true. But I'm happy to tell you that most of them are proud enough of themselves and happy enough with the way they look that they are continuing to practice the ancient law, which is to only marry within your own caste. Now, in Europe, this was to the point where we had the royal class and the noble class, the aristocracy, and the peasant class. And again, nobility and certainly the monarch, the royal class, did not marry anything but a royal person, a person of that class. And that's how they preserve their ancient bloodline, as do some yellow races, which is extremely important. It's like breeding dogs. If you want to have a good puppy, you have to take a good female and a good male and breed them. And even then, sometimes mistakes happen. But generally speaking, you can preserve those ancient bloodlines, which I'm sorry to say, many of us to this day despise our ancient bloodlines, and especially many of us look down on the royal classes of Europe, which I think is a mistake, because it is in those bloodlines that our finest genetic material is to be found. Throughout the last century, the Jews pretty much obliterated those ancient bloodlines. That was their primary purpose, or at least one of their primary purposes, in the writings that we see in the protocols of the elders of Zion, where it says even the finest of the white or of the Gentiles should be destroyed. Well, I think that that's a misconception. I don't think it was even the whites, the best whites, should be destroyed. I think that they intentionally zeroed in on the best bloodlines of the white race. So we need to do everything we can to shore up our bloodlines and give due respect to people who fortunately even today have the high intelligence that goes with the perfect symmetrical face and those beautiful qualities that are not just beauty but actually marks of a superior person. And I don't hear a lot of that among white people, especially white Americans. We seem to take pride in showing contempt for the ancient European bloodlines. Of course, when you're looking at today's king and we have a queen of England today, many people feel that she's not an actual white person, that she has Jewish blood. But I'm not so sure of that. At any rate, there's no good that's going to come from tearing down what we have left of our ancient hierarchies and all mix into one group. Even if it's the white race, it's not good for a healthy white person to marry an unhealthy white person, because you're bringing in those bad genetic qualities into your child. So I wanted to make the point that we need to reestablish, and I'm looking at Vedic law, ancient Hindu law teaches the differences between the characters and the personalities of the different castes, and I recognize this to be true. Because I'm lucky enough to have a few white friends that are clearly very high class, higher, better quality than I am. And I can see these qualities in these people. And one of them is a natural tendency to worship God in some kind of a ritualistic fashion. For example, saying grace, going to church. In the Vedic books, it will tell you that the Brahmins do this. They hold on to the ancient traditions. And I noticed that the very better upper-class white people, still, I was having lunch with a man that I took to a rally with Ernst Zindel, and I was kind of surprised because I'm not such a hot example of good stock, and he just naturally said grace before we ate. In fact, I think he's done that twice when we've gone out to lunch. And I just realized he would no more sit down and not say grace than he would do anything else. It's just the way he was brought up, and it's the way he lives. There's other qualities to look for if you're looking at an upper-class person, and if you want to emulate upper-class people, which I do, because it makes it clear in these Vedic texts, that even if you are a sudra, which is a low-class person, by practicing the disciplines of the Brahman, you can actually become a Brahman. You can purify yourself and become a Brahman. We see many women in America taking advantage of the breaking down of our class system. I know you've all met them, and some of you think they're kind of silly because they will only speak oh so properly, and they insist that the house has to be kept properly, and they're doing this because they are naturally wanting to become better people themselves. They might have come from very, very low class backgrounds, but they just instinctively know that they can become better people if they practice the disciplines of the higher class. So one of the things about the higher class that I would like to break into is the difference in sexuality. The upper class person is not as interested in sex as the lower class person. And I know you won't believe that because we've been programmed so badly by Jewish propaganda into thinking that, as Freud teaches us, the road to salvation is to free yourself of your inhibitions and have as much sex as possible, and possibly even you could devote your life to having the best possible sex. I know very well about this mental attitude because my brother and sister adhere to this, and they're both pretty wealthy, but in today's world you can become very wealthy and not be a particularly good person. So the reason that the upper class doesn't spend so much time rutting in the fields like animals is because they have, is for two reasons. Number one, they have meaningful work to do, which requires their energy. And number two, they actually have more concern for themselves and their sex partners than to just roll around with anybody they run into. So it's a question of respect for yourself and your children and your partner just as much as anything else. And yet my brother believes that God, his God, introduces him to various sex partners and helps him become more and more sexual. He's the master of what I call geezer sex. He's always been a very attractive man, and he's always had a lot of women. And he's very gifted, and he could have been a great, great man if he hadn't wasted his energy on drugs and sex. Same thing for my sister. She's a very beautiful woman with natural platinum blonde hair. Beautiful, thick platinum blonde hair, and the face to go with it, the little wolf face. And she's brilliant, but she got hooked into the idea of sex, and she married a Jew and takes drugs and performs unmentionable acts on him whenever he gives her enough drugs to make her what he calls compliant. And she parades this relationship in front of me as if this is a successful marriage because she gets to go around with the jet-setting crowd who follow the eclipses of the moon. They have so much money. They have nothing better to do than to meet each other in these various parts of the planet where you can watch the eclipse of the moon. This is almost a religion for them. They find these little places in Chile, and they all meet at, you know, at the point, the appointed time, and they all take their drugs. Most of them have decided ecstasy is the best road to enlightenment. And they share the ecstatic experience of getting loaded and watching the full eclipse of the moon or the full eclipse of the sun. This is what these upper class people who are dealing in drugs have the time and the money to do. So her life, in my opinion, is totally wasted, and all of that beautiful blonde hair is wasted as well. Now, to tell you how beautiful my sister's hair is, because I do think it was a great gift that she was given, it's platinum blonde, and when she got old, turned 50, two streaks of silver came out of the side of her head to fall down to the length of her hair, which is about 2 feet long at all times. If she cuts it off, it goes back full and thick to about 2 feet in, it seems like about a year. She just has this beautiful gift, which is so wasted on drugs and sex and improper thinking. So we're talking about racial lines and how it's important not only to preserve your racial lines and your genetics, but also your behavior. And all of this is about the children. I wish that men thought the way they thought when I was a girl and picked out a wife thinking that this is the woman they're going to be having sex with for the rest of their life, knowing that she will be a virgin. Probably the man is going to be a virgin as well, believe it or not. In the 50s, most of them were when they got married. They fell in love. They chose each other, and they took pride in this, not for looks and sexuality, but for personality. That's what this kid said in the local high school paper when they were asked, what do you choose? We asked the little journalists asked the guys, what do you look for in a woman? Well, I'm not so interested in sex as I am for personality, or I think they said looks in those days. I'm not so interested in looks as I am in personality, because this is what they were taught by their parents. And this is what works. But the reason that it's so important that you choose your wife and that you be faithful to your wife is the number one, you want to really like her enough to give up all other women and have children by her, and this is probably going to result in the best possible child. If you think very carefully about who you want to marry and stand back and not get trapped into a marriage by having sex, which, by the way, in the 50s, we looked down on men who did that. Lower class men got trapped into marriage by having sex before marriage, and we thought, what a fool he is. He's not picking the right woman. He's letting the wrong influences determine who's going to be the mother of his children. And then think of the child after it's been born with its beautiful genetics, well matched. He then comes into a home where the mother and father both love each other exclusively, not only because they've picked each other carefully based on personality and compatibility, but because they do have sex, which is a powerful pleasure that is supposed to be shared. And so he comes, the little baby comes into this world with these two parents who are so much in love and so much more likely to stay together than parents today. So I would say that unless a man chooses his sex partner with all of this in mind, that he's going to marry her, that she's going to hand her genetic package down to his child, that this woman is most likely to be a good mother to her child, we're not looking at a Brahmin. We're looking at a Sudra. We're looking at a lower class man. And even if you're born a Brahmin, it says in the Vedic texts that if you behave like a Sudra, you actually become a Sudra. And if you are a Sudra and you behave like a Brahmin, even though you were born like a Brahmin, even though you were born a Sudra, by your behavior you can purify yourself and become a Brahmin. And in the next life you will be born a Brahmin. Now, I don't know that I believe or disbelieve any of this, but I certainly see the wisdom in the teaching, and I see it reflected in the Bible, which teaches that, now let me think about this. Now, I was going to tell you about the Bible. The Bible teaches that when a man gets married to a woman, he's not to conduct business, important business, or go to war for a year so that he can bring joy to his wife. And I think this is very important, because I think that when you have a man and a woman, and I'm not just talking about virgins, I'm talking about even people who have developed bad habits, it still takes a year for the bodies of the man and the woman to become united in one flesh and one spirit to the point where the woman can easily enjoy sex the way a man can, which is not natural for a woman because it's not her primary biological drive. It's not to just spread seed, but to nurture a child. So she's just not created to have sex and to enjoy sex as easily as a man is. So I think that's a very important precept, that when you do get married, you take a year off and enjoy yourselves and relax with each other. And after a year, you don't have to read any sex books. You'll be just fine. Now, the Vedic texts teach that, and I love this, that a Brahmin man is only supposed to have sex with his wife when she's in season. And of course we know that women don't go into season like animals do, so I had to think that through and I figured it out. What it means is he should only have sex with her when she wants to have sex, which the ancient Aryan Hindus thought was the same as going into season, which I think is kind of cute. But you can see the wisdom of this. The Brahmin man only has sex with his wife, and only when she wants it. What a nice man he is. He would never rape her like the lower class men, and I'm sure that they would have a very happy life together, and that he would probably be happy with her for the rest of his life if he treats her so politely. So we're getting into what I believe is the search for the Holy Grail here, when we're talking about sex and marriage and children and how to produce beautiful children and save the race, which in our case will be utterly destroyed if we don't follow these laws. Because again, remember, we have recessive genes. If a white man marries a non-white woman, he doesn't have a 50-50% chance of having white children. It's not an equal playing field. It's not like taking beans, white beans and brown beans, in the garden and putting them together, and then here comes 50% brown beans and 50% white beans. And then they learn that they can mutate these genes and get them to produce beans, you know, like beans that you eat. They've learned how to, there are some beans that, in a sense, intermarry. They produce 25% white beans and 25% brown beans and 25% mixed beans. And that's true in nature. When you have a balanced genetics, not one recessive and the other dominant, but just they're both the same, you get 25% white, 25% black, and 50% brown. But we have recessive genes because our genes are much more delicate, having had almost 1 million years to develop into what we know we are today, what we should be, which is tall, slender, blue-eyed, and blonde with IQs of at least 130 or 140. That's our true genetic package before it was devolved by intermarrying. In our case, if you take a white person and a black person, hate to even bring up that idea, but a white person and a black person, you don't have a chance of 50% brown children and 25% white children and 25% black children, which would be an equal genetic playing field. You have recessive genes, so your chances of having a white baby are only 1 in 8. The likelihood is that you will have one white baby, you'll have one white baby, 3 black babies, and 4 mixed babies. So that's why when you look at history, you see very quickly when the white race starts lowering its barriers and intermarrying with other races, the city goes from black to brown, white to brown almost immediately, within a generation or two, as we saw in ancient Egypt, which right now when they're digging up mummies, these mummies are tall, slender, with reddish hair. So it looks like there's even proof with the mummies, much less the obvious that who except white people could build those pyramids. So the search for the Holy Grail is a key to all this. Most of you, I would like to think, have heard of it as a concept. I heard of it when I was a kid, and I thought, what a wonderful thing that these knights are on the search for the Holy Grail, and the Holy Grail was symbolized by the grail, which is a word for cup that Jesus used when he was giving the Last Supper, and everybody was thinking if they could find the Holy Grail, they'd get powerful magic. But what has turned up in this recent book, what is the name of that book about the search for the Holy Grail? It'll come to me. It's one that we're not supposed to read because it says that Jesus had kids, which is impossible, of course. Jesus did not have children. But what Jesus did have was parents, aunts, uncles, and a whole bloodline of which he was one. And the search for the Holy Grail, in my opinion, is a search for the holy bloodline of Jesus Christ. Because when you take the word Holy Grail and spell it, it gets spelled San Grail, which means holy cup, holy grail. But if you spell it another way, Sangre Royale, you get royal blood. And I think that this code word, which has been a secret for 2,000 years, has been kept secret by the white race, and with just this little titillating idea, you will be saved when you understand the search for the Holy Grail. But it's a mystery, and nobody knows what it means. Well, what it means is the holy bloodline of Jesus Christ, which is the holy white race, which is the blue-blooded race, which means that when you turn over your arm and look at the veins on the underside of your arm, if they're blue, then you're a blue blood. That means you're a white person. So we have had to hide this quest of the Holy Grail, or preserving the Holy Bloodline, which we know to be true because of this mystery. The search for the Holy Grail has been kept hidden and obscure, because people know they can kill us. They can destroy us by simply intermarrying with us. So that's the most important thing for the white race. Of course, we will always have the best weapons, and we'll always be the best in battle because we are strong and smart. But the most important thing of all is that we not intermarry, and that we maybe not tell people outside of our race that that's going to be our main project, because they will then become even more interested in intermarrying with us than they already are, simply because we're so much prettier than they are. Now, did you know that Hitler wrote a sequel to Mein Kampf? In the sequel to Mein Kampf, he talks about America, and he says that America could be a wonderful country to emulate, because we were, at that time, in the 30s, pretty diligently practicing eugenics, which, of course, Hitler was very interested in. Eugenics is what I've been talking about, the science of reproducing healthy children. Hitler thought that because of the massive industrial wealth of the United States and the Immigration Act of 1924, which only allowed white people to come into our country, and the fact that we had segregation and eugenics boards, that we were onto something. And so he had a lot of respect for us. He thought that Germany should emulate our practices, and of course he was totally right. Unfortunately, we were tricked by the Jews, who got a hold of our paper, our newspapers, and our news press, into killing and destroying this wonderful people, the German people, who to this day have not been able to stand up and refuse to go along with this destruction of freedom of speech that we see, where they have to go to jail for 5 years or more if they even talk about the Holocaust with a question like, did 6 million Jews really die? Well, we're not going to answer that question, because it's against the law to ask it, so you have to go to jail for 5 years. These anti-hate speech laws have been passed throughout Europe in 9 European countries, and they are a blight on the land. And who caused that blight? Our American fathers and mothers and grandparents, who went to Europe and bombed the beautiful Germanic cities and committed fratricide against our own people. So we have a real guilt to face here, not any guilt against what we did to the Jews, because that's all lies, but we do have a burden of guilt about what we did to our own people, and we have to restore ourselves by repenting these crimes. That's what we need to spread around to our brothers and sisters in the United States when they start talking about the evil white race. No, we're not evil in the sense that we're told we were evil. We didn't purposely give Indians blankets with smallpox, and we didn't exterminate any Jews. We certainly didn't do any harm to the slaves by upgrading them, bringing them to this beautiful country and letting them see what civilization is like. But we have done harm to ourselves, and we have to stop this and start apologizing and telling our friends, our fellow white people who are not awake, that this is the crime we've committed. We have allowed ourselves to be used in these fratricidal wars where we've gone against our own people, because we were convinced to by clever Jews who are masters of manipulation. Now, how did this happen to us? It's not too hard to figure out that once you open your city gates to the enemy, your enemy, being a loyal alien, is going to try to steal what you have. That's what people do. That's what they're supposed to do. Each race is supposed to fight for itself. When you see the Mexicans coming into this country and announcing that they're going to take it over, of course, it's all right to hate them, and certainly they should be deported, but it's silly, really, to hate them. You should respect them and have respect for yourself, where you say, yes, you're going to try to take over my country, but I'm going to fight you off. I'm going to defend my country. So it's not a question of these people being evil people. It's a question of us being weak and letting them come in and then not rising up in opposition when they state that they're going to fulfill their genetic imperative by trying to take our territory away from us. The proper response is, well, see if you can. We're going to resist that. So that's what we have to do with these Mexicans and these yellows and these Jews who come into our country and announce to us that they are going to take our country away from us. George Orwell wrote a very important book in 1984 in which he talks about Big Brother taking over Oceania, which is the new name for London, which has been turned into a communist country. And it's very interesting that Oceania is based on the Stalin era Soviet Union, and the description of Big Brother bears a physical resemblance to Stalin. I think it's also interesting that Dustin Hoffman looks almost exactly like Stalin, because Dustin Hoffman lived a charmed life, and it seems to me that enough Jews believe in their own genetics, that when they saw Dustin Hoffman decide to be a movie star, and you can't miss the physical resemblance between Dustin Hoffman and Joseph Stalin, their genetic twin. I think that the Jews decided to give their beloved Joseph Stalin, born in, reincarnated in the body of Dustin Hoffman, the best possible life, and made sure that he became the superstar that he did. So, that's just a little side note. I actually like Dustin Hoffman. I'm not saying I don't like him. I'm just saying that it's very important to know that Joseph Stalin, looks like Dustin Hoffman, because in your travels, when you're debating, you'll hear people say that Stalin was not a Jew. Well, he was very much a Jew, and he looked like a Jew. You can see this on Jew Watch. Frank Welkner has put up the pictures of Dustin Hoffman and Joseph Stalin, and so have I, on NukeIsraelNow.com. So, this book, 1984, which is written by George Orwell, talks about Oceania, which is a description, actually, of Russia during Stalin's time, and it talks about everybody being bugged, everybody being surveilled, and that only this one man, this Winston Smith, stands against the corruption of the New World Order. Winston Smith is the hero of the book, and he protests against the New World Order, or whatever it's called, in 1984 by studying history. He is an orphan. Both of his parents were killed during the Second World War, or the war preceding the New World Order. And he's brought up in an orphanage, and he's put in charge of looking at news articles and changing them so that they match the governmental version of what history is meant to be. He worked in a newsroom, and when the news clippings come in, he changes them to fit the government's idea of what the people should believe, and he gets interested in history by doing this. Then he falls in love with a woman who works in the same part of the factory, and the two of them meet in a place where there's no surveillance, and they have their opportunity to talk over their ideas, and they come to the conclusion that the New World Order is evil, and unfortunately they are actually surveilled, and they are captured, and they are tortured, until not only does Winston tell his torturer that he sees three fingers when only two are put up in front of his face, but that's not good enough. He has to be tortured to the point where he actually sees three fingers. So the torture is used not just to make you comply by saying that you agree, but you actually have to be brainwashed to the point where you do agree with the propaganda that's being given to you by your government. So it's a story that talks about effective brainwashing in a totalitarian state. And it, and in this book, Stalin is reported to say, if you tell a big lie long enough and you keep repeating it, people will eventually come to believe it. Now, this is attributed to Joseph Stalin, although you'll find many of the talk show hosts attributing it to Hitler, as they do so many of the faults, the flaws of the Russian system, which we are constantly being told happened in Nazi Germany, but they didn't. So one of the things we need to confront with the patriotards is to correct them when they say, we are going toward a Nazi state in Nazi Germany, all these things were happening. No, it's not in Nazi Germany that these things happened. It was in Russian communist society that these things happened. And it's very hard to pick up the phone when some radio host like Alex Jones or somebody is talking and say, I want to talk to you and tell you that what you said about Nazi Germany is not true. It's actually attributable properly to communist Russia. One of the most important things that we learned when we read 1984 is that the government learned that it was not necessary to bomb the enemy in order to get the taxpayers to pay for these wars. That it was actually more expedient to bomb their own country. So it turned out in the end that the rocket bombs which fell daily on Russia were actually fired by the government of Oceania itself just to keep people frightened. And this is so important to us today when we see that our government is committing terror against our own people with 9/11, for instance, which is obviously was a controlled demolition. And the Pentagon, which was probably hit by a missile, not by an airplane. The most exciting and wonderful example of what these horrible governing people have been doing to us since Waco, when they killed those people in Waco with firebombs and burned them alive, over 88. I think they say that they killed 88, but I think that's probably they killed more. And also Ruby Ridge, that was, I think, the first time we saw our government going in and killing our own people. But this is what we can expect if we don't figure out a way around it, that the people who control our government are perfectly willing to bomb our own country, if that'll keep us frightened enough to keep them in power. Now, in China, what the government does when the people get out of control is it just turns off the water. And in 3 days, the people do whatever it is they weren't willing to do. So the government can control us through turning off our water. They can bomb us. There's a lot of things they can do. And I think the best way to fight back is to be faithful to our own kind by not intermarrying, and to keep talking to one another. I find that the internet has had a very powerful effect on our people. We've become much stronger as a race because we're able to communicate with each other. And through the internet, develop ideas. And the most important idea that developed almost overnight was, white people are not bad. And we don't have to take this abuse anymore. Then we started piling idea upon idea upon idea. And we found out, lo and behold, the Ku Klux Klan is not bad. And then, oh my gosh, the Germans were not bad. And then we got to where we're at today, which is we're kind of looking around and saying, we've really been hoodwinked by Jews, and we're going to have to fight SOG. Now, another thing that happened in 1984 was the key word there, if you recall, they had a new way of speaking, which was called New Speak, which conveyed the ideas of the totalitarian state. The one key word was black-white. This was a word that was used to convey the idea that a word can mean the exact opposite of what it claims to mean, because you are not supposed to be able to tell the difference between black and white. It's all the same. And how many of us have heard these strange New Age religions, which are nothing like the Hinduism I talked to you about in the first half hour? But they're just this airy-fairy idea that there's no difference between good and evil, there's no difference between black and white, only the primitive mind distinguishes between opposites. Well, this is just crazy. And it will drive a man crazy. That's intended to drive us crazy. We're supposed to believe that we haven't got the power to distinguish between variables or black and white. So that idea was expressed in 1984 with this idea of newspeak, where the word black-white meant it's all the same. There's no difference. The plot of the story about Winston, I pretty much told you. You should know it if you don't want to read the book. Everybody's very poor. Winston lives in a squalid one-room apartment in the Victory Mansion, becomes fascinated by the past, falls in love with another girl, with a girl who is another employee in the INCSOC, it's called, or English Socialism News Media, and they have their love affair. They get caught and they get tortured, and the beauty of the torture, or the perfection of the torture, is not fully expressed to the reader until Winston finally meets Julia after having been tortured to the point where he said, do it to Julia first. Do it to Julia, don't do it to me. And then when he meets her, the love between them has died, probably because of the guilt he feels about having betrayed her under the hands of the torture master. As I've said in the past, torture is not a tool of the white race, and it must never be. Anyone who starts thinking they can further the cause, any kind of divine cause or cause for good, using torture, has clearly lost Brahmin status and is acting like a Sudra or a non-white. How can you improve your situation by torturing people until they tell you things? Since people will tell you anything when they're tortured. All these people in Guantanamo Bay, which are apparently starting to confess crimes, their confessions are completely worthless. You can't get a real confession under torture. That's why our forefathers refused to allow torture to be introduced into this country under the Sixth Amendment against cruel and unusual punishment. Not only because we didn't want to lower ourselves to animal status, or demon status, actually, since animals don't torture each other, but demons do. Not only did our forefathers want their children and their children's children to live as humans and not as demons, but the information is completely useless. So here we see George Bush torturing people and getting them to admit to things, and then these confessions are broadcast. And who's stupid enough to believe these confessions that are obtained under torture? Why are we afraid of the Jews? Because the Jews are fearful people. They are torture masters. They torture their children. They mutilate their children. They mutilate their children's genitalia with circumcision. And there is a right that they have. One of their religious rights is they take witches during their high holy days, and they beat their male adolescent children in order to cleanse them. These whips were being sold in the temple when Jesus went in and routed all of the money changers and the people that were selling these animals for sacrifice. He grabbed the whips out of their hands. These whips are still used today in some forms of Judaism. You can look them up on the internet. And he started beating the rabbis with the whips that he made. I think he grabbed several whips and made one whip out of them and started whipping these Jews for having disgraced God's character by promoting the idea that God will give you a favor, he will bless you, if you torture an animal to death on an altar until there's blood on the altar. The Hindus do the same thing, which really worries me, because anytime you see torture being introduced into an observance to honor God, you know that the God has been lost. The idea of the loving God has been perverted, and now people are worshiping an evil God that likes torture. Well, that's not the nature of the God that Jesus revealed. So when you're studying religion, if you see that cropping up, you have to realize that that religion has been tainted. So these Jews are worshiping a God that is not the God of love. White Christians have a responsibility to keep such people out of their city's limits. We can't have people killing animals on altars to their gods so that the altars become bloody, as the Muslims do. That's why we can never really be friends with the Muslims, even though we appreciate the fact that they recognize that Jesus is a true prophet of God. And that's nice of them to do that, because he certainly is. But they don't understand what Jesus was teaching, which is that God is not pleased with torture, death. They don't grasp that. They still believe that Abraham was a righteous man when he walked up the mountain with his son Isaac. Isaac was the one who had, the little kid had to carry the sticks that were going to be used to offer him up as a burnt offering to God. Don't you think that Abraham is a mean person? I do. Don't you think it's mean, for instance, to take your dog on a walk because the dog is sick and you're going to kill him and bury him? You take your dog on a walk with you into the forest and you make him watch you dig the grave, and then you shoot him in the head and put him in the grave? I think that's horrible. And I think the idea of Abraham making his son carry the sticks that are going to be used for his own burning is such a horrible act that I think we should kick Abraham out of the family line. There's nothing good about this man, and I don't want any part of the covenant that is involved in. So, anyway, the Jews are a fearful people. We probably are right to fear them and hate them, as did the people in the Bible. In many, many times in the Bible, you will see the phrase, for fear of the Jews. In John, it talks about no man speaking openly about Jesus for fear of the Jews. Well, what were they afraid of? Probably the same thing we're afraid of, that the Jews would capture them and torture them and kill them and eat them for Passover, which is what Jews do. And then they talk, there's another place in John 9:22. These words spoke to parents because they feared the Jews. I forgot what the Jews, what the parents said, something about approving of, that if any man did confess that he was Christ, he would be put out of the synagogue. Now, I don't recall Jesus ever saying he was Christ, by the way, except when he was ranting under terrible pressure of about to be crucified. He did say some things that could be interpreted as saying he was Christ. But I know that what Jesus said was he was not Christ. When they tried to give him a crown, he said, he refused the crown, and he said, why callest thou me good? There is none good save God. And I frankly do not believe that Jesus wanted to be made divine or to be seen as divine, except in the sense that all good people are divine and are connected through lineage to God and ultimately meet God in heaven. But many religions teach that against obvious. So we see another time where we talk about for fear of the Jews, and that's in John 20:19. That's not the one I wanted to say. I want to talk about Joseph of Arimathea. In John 19:38, it says, after Joseph of Arimathea, being a disciple of Christ, of Jesus, but secretly for fear of the Jews, besought that he might take away the body of Jesus, and Pilate gave him leave. He came, therefore, and took the body of Jesus. Now, let's look at Joseph of Arimathea. He is the guy that took the body of Christ down from the cross at 3 p.m. on the eve of Passover. 3 p.m. is the time on the eve of Passover. 3 p.m. is the time to this day that the Jews bring all their parishioners in a line with their sacrificial animals, rams, usually chicken, and they have their slaughter session in front of the children. Isn't this a terrible practice to make your children watch as the priest tortures animals to death by cutting their throat halfway and then letting them experience the agony of death as they bleed to death? Chicken after chicken after chicken after chicken at 3 p.m. to this day. This is when they have their slaughter session. So here's Joseph of Arimathea getting Jesus down off the cross at 3 p.m. Doesn't it make sense that it was important for him to get Jesus down off the cross at exactly 3 p.m.? Because that was the exact time of day that the rabbis were holding their slaughter session. So we have Joseph of Arimathea, who was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly for fear of the Jews. So he was kind of a secret disciples of Jesus. Now, I suggest that Joseph of Arimathea was a double agent, that he was a secret follower of Jesus because he wasn't a real follower of Jesus. He was pretending to be a follower of Jesus so that he would have the authority to get that body down off the cross in time for the slaughter session so that Jesus could be duly tortured to death at the right time to satisfy the blood ritual laws of the Jews then as well as today. And I think we need to be very serious in looking at the Jewish tendency to sacrifice our people for their Jewish ritual, their murder, their ritual murder. We have another good example of that in the Feast of Purim. Now, the Feast of Purim is a feast where the Jews gather together to this day, and they make little pastries in the shape of a triangle, and they put fruit in it, and they serve it at the dinner table to the children, and they say, "We are eating the year of Haman, the ear, as in eyes, ears, and nose, of Haman, to remember that we killed Haman when he was trying to get the king to kill all the Jews. We defeated some bad guy that wanted to exterminate us, and we celebrate it by eating his body parts." Now, I find this troubling, especially because the Feast of Purim comes at the same time in the year that good, decent Christians are starting Lent in preparation for our Passover, which is a celebration of Jesus overcoming death and spreading the truth to all of us that God is love. That's how Christians are dealing with this time of the year. The Jews are eating the body parts of Haman. And I think that that's reprehensible enough so that we should demand, as Hitler did, that these people leave our midst. We should not have to even worry about our blonde children being stolen from us, crucified, and eaten on high Jewish holy days, which we know there's a history of, because we have the books written by the monks over the last 2,000 years. Well, there weren't any Christian monks 2,000 years ago, that's true, but there are historical references to this practice of the Jews killing non-Jews and eating them for Passover and their other high holy days. In fact, the Talmud gives instructions on how to kill human sacrifices and eat them. It's done the same way they kill their animals. You cut the throat halfway and let the victim bleed to death. Only they seem to throw crucifixion in there sometimes, too. They get very, very ugly with their torture, which is another reason that I appeal to my white brothers and sisters never to descend to this level, because I don't want you turning into sutras. I want you to be Brahmins. I want you to be humans. I want you to go to heaven. So you simply cannot take on the characteristics of the Jews. Now, the kosher method of murder, the kosher method of killing, not only is inflicting death by torture upon poor animals, which Hitler outlawed, but we are also being taxed for it. So, about 95% of the food that you are eating, a tiny tenth of a cent, goes to pay the kosher tax to the rabbi who has blessed this good, otherwise good American food. And that's why we have to fend off these Jews with their evil religion and go back to be decent Christians again. Take a look at The Russian Specialist, starring Dolph Lundgren. It's a wonderful movie about Russia, and it's pretty racially accurate. It shows how the Jews capture beautiful white girls and use them for sex, and how a good white man rescues one of them. It's well worth watching. The Russian Specialist by Dolph Lundgren. Thank you.
ladies and gentlemen.